I asked Mr. Burns how this could be done so quickly, and he verbally advised me, hockey owes me. Hockey owes me.
These were the three words allegedly uttered by Liberal Party fundraising chief Andrew Burns.
I found that owes me comment strange in the circumstances.
Burns was allegedly telling an executive of his company, Hello World, the reason he was able to arrange a meeting with Australian Ambassador to the US, Joe Hockey, on very short notice.
No comment from the minister?
In a Senate estimates hearing, Labor Senator Penny Wong laid bare the claim facing the former Treasurer. Hockey owes me, she said. Last week in Parliament, questions were asked about free flights for Finance Minister Matthias Cormann from the CEO of travel company Hello World.
Now this scandal, this Chumgate scandal, has entered a dangerous new phase.
The trips, worth several thousands of dollars, may once have had repercussions beyond a few bad headlines. And it only got worse.
Liberal candidate in the Adelaide Hills, Georgina Downer, mocked up her own cheque to claim a taxpayer-funded sports grant to a local bowling club.
The icing on the cake? The giant cheque that Downer handed over had her face on it and was emblazoned with the words Georgina Downer, Liberal for Mayo. And now an inquiry may be afoot.
That type of a self-promotional activity is what members and candidates do.
But somehow these were not the only questionable revelations from the last week.
Federal Attorney General Christian Porter is defending his decision to hand a plum job to a former Liberal colleague.
It wasn't long before the Federal Attorney General was in front of the camera, explaining why he'd given his former Liberal Party colleague Joe Francis a position on the Administrative Appeals Tribunal.
Porter says the bus wasn't a gift, he just hasn't paid for it yet. It used to be that the standard we held for our elected leaders was not just to be innocent of the allegations made against them, we wanted them to be beyond reproach. Did we miss something? Did the standard we hold our politicians to change somehow? From the Sydney Morning Herald and The Age, this is Please Explain. I'm Jacqueline Mailey. This week, why does it seem that there is one rule for us and another for politicians? Joining us on the panel today is Associate Editor and Special Writer Tony Wright, who has seen his fair share of political scandals and sackings in his time. Tony, welcome.
Thanks very much, Jack.
Also joining us is Investigative and Legal Affairs Journalist Michaela Whitborn, who's been following the emergence of the Federal Anti-Corruption Watchdog that may just fix this mess. Hello.
Hello.
Michaela. Later on, we're going to be speaking to former Senior Judge Anthony Wheely, who is a transparency expert who's worked on a proposal for a Federal Integrity Commission. But first, Tony, can you just take us through the last few weeks of revelations that have come out about various politicians' interests that have been a little bit interesting or perhaps controversial?
Well, I don't think interesting or controversial covers it, really. It's like the last days of Rome as we head to this election that seems to be interminably upon us without us actually having a chance to get to it. But, of course, there was the Hello World matter that really did get things rumbling last week. A minister like Matthias Cormann, who's the finance minister, professes not to know that somebody hadn't taken $2,780 out of his credit card to pay for a family trip. For more than a year, he didn't know this until journalists rang him up and from The Age and the Sydney Morning Herald and said, did you pay for these tickets? He said, well, I thought I did. And we know where that went. And then that drifted towards Washington, where Joe Hockey, who is a firm friend of the head of Hello World, was dragged into it somewhat by revelations within a Senate committee that a not altogether happy former employee of Hello World says that he was asked by the chief to go from London to Washington and meet Joe Hockey to talk about what Hello World could provide for their travel arrangements in the United States, according to his evidence. He said, you can't organise a visit so quickly with an ambassador like Joe Hockey. And Mr. Burns, the head of Hello World, said, yes, you can. He owes me. Well, when that was dropped into a Senate committee, I think you could hear a pin drop. Now, we don't know that anyone's actually done anything wrong or otherwise. It's the look. And when you have very practiced politicians like Matthias Cormann and Joe Hockey, who's a former politician, not recognising what the look can be, then perhaps you have a problem.
It should be noted as well that the Hello World did not actually win the contract with the Australian Embassy in Washington. So, but it did win a contract or was renewed a contract with the Finance Department under Matthias Cormann, although, of course, he says there's no improper conduct there. We had another couple coming off the back of the Hello World scandal, though, didn't we? Or if you want to call it a scandal. We had Christian Porter and the matter of a bus, a campaign bus.
Yes.
The Michaelia Cash matter. Do you want to just take us through those very quickly?
Well, you mentioned Christian Porter. Of course, he's the Attorney General. And he, apart from the bus for a second, he appointed a whole cascade of former Liberal grandees to the Administrative Appeals Tribunal, which pays very handsomely. And one of these was one of his own ex-staffers got a job just 2 months after he left Christian Porter's office. It's for $244,520 a year, 7 year. Full-time position on the review tribunal.
Just for context, the government of the day, and particularly Home Affairs Minister Peter Dutton, particularly dislikes this Administrative Appeals Tribunal and the decisions that it makes, doesn't it, Tony? Because it reviews government decisions such as immigration decisions and often reverses them.
It does, and it also should be said that it's not unusual for a government of any shade to stack the ranks of the AAT with former politicians or those associated with the party in power. But coming on top of the sort of things that we've been talking about, and then the Michaelia Cash and Michael Keenan matter, once again from a Senate committee, where it turns out the police say they believed they had enough evidence to mount prosecutions relating to the knowledge or otherwise of people associated with the government on raids on the offices of the Australian Workers Union. The police say they had enough evidence to mount prosecutions, but been told by the Director of Public Prosecutions that in the absence of enough evidence, which included witness statements from these two ministers, Michaelia Cash and Michael Keenan, there was no reasonable prospect of convictions. Well, the two ministers had failed to provide witness statements to investigators, according to the police, although Senator Cash says she made a statement by sending the police a copy of her Hansard record of answers to a previous Senate committee. Well, it just sounded like they were having a lend, really. And that's really the whole sort of feel of the last couple of weeks, which, of course, were the last serious weeks of Parliament before you have a budget in April and then the election will be called.
As you wrote very eloquently last week, previously we've seen ministers resign because they didn't declare a teddy bear.
Paddington Bear, long time ago.
And another minister who resigned or stood aside after declaring that a TV was black and white and not colour to avoid paying border tax. Has the standard for which politicians resign for things changed?
There's no doubt that that's happened over a long period. We talk about the Paddington Bear affair. That goes back to 1984 and the colour TV matter, which got a Liberal minister, Mr McKellar, back in 1982. But of course, John Howard decided he would lift the bar of ministerial responsibility and lost, I think, 7 ministers in a year before deciding that the bar was a wee bit too high. Since then, it hasn't been very common at all for ministers to take responsibility by stepping aside, pending an inquiry, or actually stepping down for matters of propriety or impropriety, perceived or actual. The last one, of course, was Andrew Broad, who was pinged by a magazine, women's magazine, for his behaviour in Hong Kong with a sugar babe. He had no choice, obviously, and that was an open and shut case. But you're just not going to find ministers falling on their swords in the lead-up to an election because there is a perception that they haven't done the right thing or there is impropriety.
I want to come back to you in a minute to ask what the effects on public trust of that might be. But first of all, Michaela, the federal government has proposed bringing in a federal ICAC. Do you think that some of this behaviour would fall under the remit of a federal ICAC?
Well, that's an interesting question. It is hard to say if any of this conduct would fall within the remit of the CIC, which differs quite markedly from the New South Wales Independent Commission Against Corruption. So the threshold for commencing an investigation under the CIC model is pretty high. It has to be satisfied that a specific criminal offence has been committed, or at least that they have a suspicion that that has occurred. And they're set out in this draft document for setting up the CIC. So it could be things like receiving a bribe, receiving a corrupt benefit as a Commonwealth public official, or abuse of public office. So whether or not the alleged conduct in any of these cases falls within that description is unclear. That's a pretty high level of criminality or alleged misconduct.
But would they have their own investigators then to, you know, you've got to do a fair bit of legwork before you can work out whether have a reasonable idea of whether an offence might have been committed. So will they have their own investigators who take tips? And
that is one of the problems with this proposal, that critics suggest that this threshold is set far too high and it would be difficult for them to even commence an investigation without a considerable amount of evidence already pointing to a potential criminal offence already having been committed. So, you know, ex-ICAC commissioners have said, well, you can't start at that point because it's only once you start looking into things that you can even, you know, that you have any grounds at all for launching a full-scale investigation. So if you already need to have that information at your disposal, you're setting the threshold for triggering an investigation far too high. And many of these cases of alleged wrongdoing will just go uninvestigated.
So is the idea that you would actually get criminal convictions out of a federal ICAC or a federal integrity commission body, or is it sort of more going to have a deterrent effect, a sort of policing effect?
Well, that's the thing. I think that to have a deterrent effect, a lot more of it would have to happen out in the open, and that's certainly the case with the New South Wales ICAC. So nobody really wants to be hauled before that commission, certainly now that they know what those public hearings are like. This is all going to happen behind closed doors before potentially the CIC makes a recommendation that police should lay charges over a particular matter. So if none of this happens in the open, I don't think that many people are going to be deterred. The threshold for, you know, laying charge against a person is pretty high. If the CIC never reaches any degree of satisfaction that it has a suspicion that a particular offence has been committed before it even launches an investigation, most of this conduct is really just going to remain hidden.
So, and I should make it clear as well that we're talking about the Coalition's proposal for a federal integrity commission, which of course has been, from what I can tell, supported by pretty much no one except the Coalition members themselves, and maybe not even all of them. And it essentially would be a transparency body that has no transparency itself, it sounds like.
Yeah, so it's all happening behind closed doors. It's essentially like a police force that does things in secret and then makes recommendations to the police that they do some more investigation, which seems to really miss the point of having an integrity body.
And they have a sort of distinction between the way they treat law enforcement officials and other public officials. Is that right?
That's right. So it's all very Animal Farm that, you know, some animals are more equal than others. Yeah. So we've got this split between the law enforcement division and the public sector integrity division. And politicians will be pleased to know that nothing that they do can be investigated in a public inquiry and no findings of corruption can be made against them in public. So really nothing will come of any of those investigations except potentially some criminal charges, which could have been investigated by the police in any case. Mm-hmm. We have a police force that can look into those things.
So it's a little bit of, it sort of goes back to the edict of justice needing to be seen to be done as well as being done.
Yes. So, you know, if you're going to have one of these bodies, you might as well have it doing something.
Yeah. And I mean, you hang out with barristers and even solicitors from time to time, I believe.
Sometimes I deign to hang out
sipping cocktails and drinking cappuccino.
All of that.
What is the legal community saying about the way the proposed federal ICAC might work?
Well, I suppose it depends who you ask. If you define the community as Margaret Kinnean, she says that, you know, this body might have some merit.
For our Victorian listeners, that's a New South Wales barrister who has herself been brought before the New South Wales ICAC.
Yes, and she successfully challenged its power to investigate her, and so there never was an inquiry. Not that we're suggesting that there was any wrongdoing there. But, you know, the profession at large and certainly former commissioners of the New South Wales ICAC certainly don't see any merit with this proposal and say that it's really the ICAC you have when you don't want to have an ICAC. And I think that really does say it all. There are so many gaps in this proposal and so many ways for politicians and others to avoid scrutiny that I don't really see the point in it at all.
We might just take a break there and come back after our interview with Justice Anthony Whealy. When the powers and remit of the proposed federal ICAC were announced, many senior members of the legal community, for lack of a better term, freaked out. Former Judge Stephen Charles called it a sham. Former New South Wales ICAC Commissioner David Ipp said it fell disastrously short of providing an effective anti-corruption agency. Anthony Whealy is a QC and a former senior judge who is a member of an independent committee of five former judges who have created a blueprint for a Commonwealth Integrity Commission. We are very honoured to have Anthony in this studio with us today. Welcome, Anthony.
Hello.
Now, Anthony, before you came, I understand you did a little bit of uncommissioned homework and you had a look at ministerial resignations that we've seen and the reasons thereof since Federation.
Yes, I thought at a federal level, I asked myself, what is enough to make a minister resign? So I looked at the sort of broad categories and then I looked at the details as far as I could. Of course, they go back a long way, so I concentrated more on what's been happening in the last 30 or 40 years. And I would say that the answer to the general question is that ministers resign or are forced to resign, obviously, if they've committed dishonest criminal behaviour, if they've offended against what might be called modern morality in a serious way, then there are situations where there's been a blatant misuse of executive power. Mm-hmm. That was the sort of thing that happened if you go back to the Whitlam era and the dismissal and so on, and the Kemlani affair.
Mm-hmm.
There are things that people may have forgotten about, but the pretty serious misuse of executive power in relation to raising finance. Yep. But in recent times, it seems to me that the only long list of resignations, for example, when Mr. Turnbull was challenged, are for people who want to oppose him but who have been his loyal ministers and suddenly decide that loyalty is not a good quality.
So there are, the cascade of ministers that we saw resign in the lead up to Turnbull being ousted.
Exactly.
It was to shift political power as opposed to maintain the integrity of the system.
That's right. And the same thing happened, of course, with the with Rudd, Gillard, Abbott. Turnbull, so we see this great lot of ministers resigning, all for reasons that have got nothing to do with probity at all. So it seems to me that you could draw a general conclusion that the we don't see ministers resigning very frequently at all for reasons of probity or lack of probity. There have been a couple, you know, sexual offences committed while in Hong Kong, things like that. But we needn't go into the detail.
Loosely term a sex scandal.
Yes.
I want to talk to you about public confidence because it seems to me that the idea of a federal integrity commission is seeking to protect public confidence in our political system. So should we be able to hold a public hearing into anything at all if it's deemed to be in the public interest?
Well, I think that the sort of body that you're talking about and which I belonged to when I was a member of ICAC in New South Wales, is a body that's concerned with administrative misbehaviour.
Mm.
So it's not just every type of misbehaviour, but it's got to be serious misbehaviour. It should be not necessarily criminal, but certainly serious. Mm. Can I give one example?
Please do.
You know, well, obviously, if a crime's committed, that's something that should be investigated. And often, if it's a crime that's tantamount to corruption, then that's easy enough to spot. But if you have, for example, a situation where a very large donation is made to a political party, or a very large donation is made to a member of Parliament's campaign, and then a favour is done back to the person who gave the money. A question mark arises, is this in order or not? Mm. Now, there may be no crime committed there. Mm. It's not exactly a bribe. But and it's also very hard to prove that the favour emanated because of the donation itself. But that needs to be investigated. So it's not criminal behaviour, but it can sometimes be very serious corrupt conduct.
What you're talking about there, the idea of a large donation being made and then a favour or a, some sort of financial benefit flowing to the person who made the donation, that would encompass what happened last week with Matthias Cormann and Hello World, whether or not, I mean,
It could.
The finance department, whether, I mean, Matthias Cormann, of course, says that he had no decision-making at all involved in the decision to renew the contract of Hello World with the finance ministry, but there was the favour, if you want to call it that, of the free flights that he says he didn't know were free. So that whole incident could fall under the remit of a federal ICAC in
It's certainly something that a federal ICAC could and perhaps should look at. I'm not suggesting in that particular case that it would necessarily follow that there was any wrongdoing at all. Sure. It may have just been, as Matthias Cormann said, an oversight. But no doubt about it, that's the sort of thing that should be looked at. And then another example connected to that was the fact that Joe Hockey was apparently available to arrange a meeting between the government and a subsidiary of Hello World.
And even though Joe Hockey is no longer a federal politician, the fact that he's still a public servant would mean that he would fall under the remit of a federal interrogation.
Well, even if he didn't, you know, we believe that a federal ICAC should be able to look at the behaviour of people who aren't parliamentarians and who aren't necessarily public servants if their interaction with parliamentarians or public servants or bureaucracies tends to lead to impartial decisions or unfair or dishonest decisions. And again, I'm not saying that's what happened in this case, but it is an area where a federal ICAC would investigate, but where at the moment nobody investigates, except the department itself involved.
Okay, let's move on now to the Coalition's plan for an anti-corruption body, which it has to be said, it sort of drafted quite reluctantly. It was against this idea for a long time. Now, Stephen Charles, who's a former judge, has said this body, the draft put forward by the Coalition is a sham set up to protect MPs. Your colleague, Justice Ip, has said, you know, that no one who's seen the enormous power and consequences of public hearings in the Hayne Royal Commission and the McClellan Commission involving paedophilia could argue that the private interests of private individuals outweighed the immeasurable public benefits that the public hearings of these commissions produced. So doesn't that raise the question that, you know, running a federal ICAC might just be like having a Royal Commission running all the time? And is that what we really want?
The Royal Commission into everything, I think a cartoonist said over the weekend. Well, I think it wouldn't quite work that way because a properly structured federal anti-corruption agency would have very clear definition of what corruption is. It would have very clear statements of when a public hearing could be held, and that would embrace the idea of protecting people's reputation so that it would only be in cases where the public interest really demanded that there should be a public hearing. And secondly, a public hearing would only be heard after there had been private hearings heard. Mm-hmm. You can imagine just as a matter of practice that the way these bodies work is that somebody reports something that looks possibly dishonest or corrupt. Preliminary inquiries are made. It seems that there may be some substance in it. So the forces gather together. Some people are called private hearings, and they are private. No one is allowed to reveal the contents.
So that'd
of those.
Be like a detective interviewing.
It's an
people.
Investigation, yeah. just yeah. like the police do. Only there are wider powers because the powers entitle the commission to force people to answer questions, even though they might incriminate them. Mm-hmm. The trade-off for that is the evidence can't be used against them in a trial. So after all those private hearings, you sift through them and you see some massive contradictions have emerged. Mm-hmm. And it's at that point where you can form a judgment that there is a very serious issue here and that it looks like somebody or some people are behaving corruptly in a serious manner, and it's at that point that a public hearing's called.
In terms of the referrals and how referrals are made to a federal ICAC, under the coalition's model, that is quite restricted who can make referrals, isn't it? And what's that model and what do you propose?
Well, that model, for example, would say, first of all, it's a two-tiered system. So you've got law enforcement officers, like police officers, border control people. The powers that can be rallied against corruption by those people are fairly strong. But when you get to the rest of the public sector, including parliamentarians, bureaucrats, their staff and so on, the powers and structure is very weak indeed, to such an extent that you could say it's deliberately designed to protect those people. And that's why
that
Stephen
would be terribly
Charles said
cynical
it's a sham.
Thing to say.
And now, but if you read it, you'll see that you can't, for example, you can't even instigate an investigation unless you have a reasonable suspicion that criminal conduct has occurred. So if you ring me up and you say, look, I'm very concerned because I think that this parliamentarian down the road is doing something very wrong. I notice he's got three Mercedes and he just added a swimming pool to his house. I couldn't investigate that because there's no reasonable suspicion of criminal conduct at all. But under the model we prefer, anybody can bring a complaint, and then it's up to the investigatory body to sift through that and see if it's got any substance to it. The thing that's really bad, though, I think, in that area is that if you're a member of an agency and you become concerned that the head of the agency is behaving corruptly, you can't be a whistleblower and report that.
Right.
You can't do it. The only people who can report it is the head of the agency. Do you think he's going to do it? No.
Just finally, Anthony, the number of scandals in the last few weeks alone have been quite astounding. Will a federal ICAC restore public confidence in the system, do you think, or could it possibly make it worse by having this sort of thing running constantly on our televisions?
Well, I think that what the community want, what the public want now, is a restoration of trust in our parliamentary and democratic system. There's a great lack of trust. There's a perception of mates looking after mates. No one seems to have a code of conduct that's enforced. There's nothing like a parliamentary integrity commissioner looking over the shoulders. And so the thing has gone from bad to worse, really. And you've seen that our standing on the Corruption Perception Index, the international standard, has come down quite significantly, and it's just not moving at the moment. So I think that a body of this kind, a federal anti-corruption body, would be the beginning of a restoration of trust and make the politicians, parliamentarians and the public servants behave in a better way. Yes, it probably will uncover some nasty things, and that will make the public even more cynical. But in the long run, you have to do that before better behaviour is available.
It'll be certainly very interesting to see whatever happens in this space, as they say, when the new government is elected come May, and what model we get. And I'm sure you'll have lots to say about whatever model Liberal or Labor comes up with.
I agree. It's a very important question. It's not something you really want to rush. But once there's a... First of all, I think we've got to say no to the present government's model. It's really defective in so many ways. And then after the election, whoever's in power, there'll be a lot of discussion in the parliament, crossbenches, the major parties and so on. And out of all of that, I hope it might even take 6 or 9 months, we'll have a model that does look effective. We've got plenty of people who are interested in it and plenty of people who'll help make that happen.
Certainly. It's definitely not an issue that's going away. I think it's fixed on the political agenda now, no matter which government is elected May.
Yeah.
Anthony, thank you so much for being with us today. It's
My
been
pleasure.
Such a pleasure.
Hi, I'm Jess Irvine. Thanks for listening to Please Explain. The Sydney Morning Herald and Age newsrooms are home to the country's most experienced economics editors and reporters, delivering trusted news and analysis. But we can't do it without you. Our subscribers get unlimited access to our award-winning independent journalism, plus exclusive behind-the-scenes stories you can't get anywhere else. Subscribe today and support news you can trust.
This is Please Explain. I'm Jacqueline Maley, and we're speaking here with Tony Wright and Michaela Whitbourne about the changing moral and ethical standards in politics. Tony, what do you think the public makes of all these cases? Are they actually following all the detail of these blow-by-blow sort of mini-scandals?
I don't know how much detail people are following, although if you go onto social media, you'll see that on Twitter and Facebook and so forth, there's a huge amount of public comment, and it appears that those commenting have followed the detail. But I suspect there is another very large slice of the population that is just dumbfounded by it all and sees it as politicians behaving like politicians, only more so. A national cynicism seems to have enveloped what has been going on in the last reasonable amount of time. I think it probably began this time back last year when Peter Dutton decided he would go for the leadership over Malcolm Turnbull. That all turned to soup. Matthias Cormann made a very bad blunder by coming in, a Western Australian leader of the right in West Australia, supporting Peter Dutton, a Queenslander. I don't think that went down very well in Western Australia, for instance. And then you ended up with a new Prime Minister being Scott Morrison, who everyone had seen just a few days before throwing his arms around the shoulders of the former Prime Minister, Malcolm Turnbull, and saying, he's my Prime Minister. And I think after that, things really did begin to somersault into a sort of a disbelief across the community that perhaps didn't hurt so much those who are rusted on to the coalition, but certainly propped up those who felt that things weren't quite right. And it just got worse and worse. And then these last 2 weeks just looked terrible, I think, across everywhere.
It's interesting, though, that you draw a line between what you might characterise as an act of political bastardry, particularly might characterise it that way if you were, say, Malcolm Turnbull, and other, you know, these more recent spate of incidents and media reports about what are sort of, I suppose, conflicts of interest or episodes where politicians and former politicians might have acted with some degree of impropriety. How are those two things related in the public mind, do you think?
Well, I think I go back to what I said before, politicians behaving like politicians even more so. It plays into the feeling that really we should have an election, allow the people to have a say. We've had years and years and years of leadership changes without the public being let in on the joke, if you like, right back to Rudd and Gillard and Rudd, and then Abbott and Turnbull and now Morrison. This is unprecedented in Australian political history, and I think a lot of people are very confused, and in that confusion comes a feeling of unreality and disassociation with the political and democratic process, to the point where a tremendous amount of people seem to want an election now so they can make up their minds and have their say about what is going on at the federal level.
And perhaps reinstall a bit of trust into the system. Michaela, I want to ask you about the law's role in public trust, particularly with the federal, in terms of a federal integrity commission. Can the law ever really restore public trust in a system that is, you know, viewed so cynically by the voter population at the moment?
I don't really know that it can. It can sort of tinker around the edges of that. I mean, it has a role to play, but I don't know that it can really get to the heart of things. I mean, it's important that it's there. I think it's important that we have a robust anti-corruption commission that's modelled more closely on the New South Wales Independent Commission Against Corruption. And obviously the courts then have a role in, you know, hearing any prosecutions from flowing from those sorts of investigations. But no, I mean, I think that there are other ways that these kind of issues that can be addressed, and that might be sort of codes of conduct and other means of holding politicians to account. And obviously we have a role in that too. Mm. But no one institution or sort of means of holding politicians to account can really sort of address this in full. Mm. It's the combination of all of them.
Tony, I want to go to both of you on this last question. Why do these stories actually matter? Why does it matter that the media reports them? Sometimes politicians dismiss this kind of thing as muckraking, and they, you know, they say, like Matthias Cormann said last week, that he'd made a mistake. Shouldn't politicians be allowed to make mistakes occasionally? Why report on this stuff?
Of course, they should be allowed to make a mistake, and they do. But when a whole heap of mistakes suddenly pile on top of each other at a time when it appears a government is desperate to retain power for power's sake, then it's not unusual at all that the public should have a loss of trust in what's going on at the federal level. And it's quite proper, I think, for the media to be the purveyors of the news. And if the news happens to be that a finance minister, for instance, hasn't been able to recognise that they haven't been charged on their credit card for an amount that most people would consider quite considerable, quite a reasonable sum, then why shouldn't? In fact, the media should report that and has no real choice about it. Of course, people will charge the media with running agendas, with bias, and all the rest. We're in this period where right across the world there is a lack of trust, not just with politics, but with the media in general. And we've just got to cop that and do our job.
Mm. Michaela, do you think that these stories matter? Do you think they're worth reporting, even if they're over, you know, relatively small amounts of money compared to, you know, federal budgets?
Sure. I mean, I think sometimes it's like pulling at a thread and then sometimes the whole jumper unravels. Maybe it doesn't. But, you know, our journalism was often incremental and can lead to more revelations and more people coming forward. And that's the same thing that often happens with ICAC inquiries, that you start off with the grain of an idea that maybe someone has done something wrong and then more information comes forward as it rolls along. I mean, that doesn't mean that every allegation has to be treated as, you know, the biggest controversy. We don't need to over-egg these things, but they can. I think these stories have been entirely legitimate, and that we do serve an important, you know, public interest function in exposing them.
Mm. And Tony, just finally, I want to ask you about how much scandals like this, or I don't know if you want to call them scandals or improprieties, whatever you want to call them, reports like this can damage a politician. I'm thinking, I suppose, of someone like Bronwyn Bishop, who had a very long parliamentary career, and she was a minister, she was a Speaker of the House, she had all of these roles, and she was a, you know, she was a grandee of the Liberal Party. And yet I would say that a lot of the general public will remember her for her helicopter ride. Just how much can these sorts of reports damage a politician's legacy?
Very much. I mean, Bronwyn Bishop is a perfect example. She will be remembered for her helicopter ride because it seemed that she had got to that point in her career where, oh, well, it's all right just to jump on a helicopter and chuff off instead of taking a car or whatever. I think Matthias Cormann would be rueing the day that he didn't check his credit card because, of course, people see this in the realm of, or a time when the government is pursuing those who receive welfare for small amounts of money that they want repaid with threats of jail and so forth. I mean, politicians do have a fairly high bar to get over most of the time, but in the lead up to an election, when things are going wrong all over the place, that bar becomes a bit higher. And if it appears to have reached just about ground level, as appears over the last couple of weeks in a few different cases, then of course reputations are going to suffer. But more to the point, the government or the party to which they belong in an election can be punished very smartly and harshly indeed.
As you say, we will all get to have our say on these matters and more in a little less than 3 months' time at the next general election. Tony Wright is our associate editor and special writer, and Michaela Whitborn is an investigative and legal affairs journalist. Tony, I want to thank you so much for joining us. I know you've had a particularly busy day, and Michaela, you too. It's been a pleasure to have you in the studio.
Thanks for having me.
Thanks very much, Jacqueline.
Thanks very much to our guests this week, Tony Wright, Michaela Whitborn and Anthony Wheely. If you know someone who would enjoy this week's episode, make sure you share it with them, or better yet, grab their phones and get them subscribed to get new episodes every week. Please Explain is brought to you by the newsrooms of the Sydney Morning Herald and The Age. Support the work we do. You can find the link to sign up now in our show notes, or just pop subscribe Sydney Morning Herald or The Age into your search engine. If you want to get in touch, you can, and our email is also in our show notes. This episode was produced and edited by David Escort and Rachel Dexter. Technical assistance from David McMillan. Special thanks to Amelia Maguire. And Tom McKendrick is our head of audio. I'm Jacqueline. Thank you for listening.